I want to thank everybody for coming this evening. I'd like to thank everyone for coming this evening. Shavua Tov, Chodesh Tov. We're here tonight because of Hakaras HaTov, of course, to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and I'm going to get into that in detail. A few people have said, what's this about? What's this about? So, of course, we're coming to that. I'd like to start just with a few personal Hakaras HaTovs to get started. First of all, I want to express Hakaras HaTov to the Yellen family because they invited my wife and myself to their Sudat Hodeah a few weeks ago, and until I was there, I didn't know that this was something that was still done in this day and age. I knew that it had been done by Gedolim and other people in the past, and that was mechayev future generations to keep the fast and also the Sudat Mitzvah afterwards. But thank you, Yellens, because you introduced me to a whole new area that of Halacha I didn't know about. I would also like to thank, from that same Suda, a number of people, Rav Aaron, Rafael Norden, Mayor Migdal, who I see didn't make it yet. I think he's still coming. Who else? Eli Hazen was in that conversation, during which I said, wow, maybe I should do something like this. And Rav Aaron whipped out his Palm Pilot and told me what date the Hebrew date was of my accident, which I knew, of course, in the English date. And so for that reason, we're here today as well. I want to thank my wife very, very much, who did an unbelievable job of whipping this thing together. I helped a little bit, but she really deserves the credit. And I thank her very, very much for making this happen. And I want to thank also Rav Lef, because I went over to Rav Lef and said to him, hey, I just heard about this thing called Sudat Hodeah. I told the Rav some of the circumstances, and the Rav got back to me a little bit later and suggested, and this is also why we're here, that because what happened to me happened 15 years ago, and I've never done anything like this to show Hakaras HaTov, that the Rav suggested that I do one time Bli Neder. So I'm saying now publicly Bli Neder. This is not something I'm taking on myself to do every year. Probably won't do it again, not for my children either. I'm very happy to have the opportunity to be here alive to do this one time, even if it is 15 years later. And I would also like to take this opportunity to thank Rav Lef for being there for us. We bother him a lot with our questions of all types, and while I consider my wife and I excellent co-captains of our family unit and on our ongoing journey, without a navigator like Rav Lef, who can be consulted day or night, I think we probably wouldn't be in the right direction at all. So thank you also to the Rav. I'm going to start with a prologue. First of all, let me just say that what happened to me I could probably tell you about in 3 minutes, but about 14 and a half years ago, towards the end of the time that I was still suffering the results of the accident, I sat down and wrote a story. And basically, had I not done that, I probably wouldn't have remembered 90% of the details today. No one has ever heard this or seen this, what I wrote. I showed it to my wife yesterday so that I could get her feedback before I got up here today and said it. But other than that, no one's never seen it. So even though it's probably going to be 10 minutes instead of 3 minutes, I'm going to beg your indulgence. Hopefully it'll be interesting anyway. But you'll know what happened. You know how when you get a new computer, I get a new computer every couple of years, and I transfer all the old files onto the new computer and so on and so forth, and all the old stuff gets erased. Well, I'm a computer geek, so that's the kind of thing I do. This happens to be the single oldest file on my computer. I have no other file close to 15 years old, but it keeps coming, one computer after the next, so it made it here till tonight, so I feel obliged to read it. I want to start with a prologue. I got myself out of order. Sorry. I didn't prepare as good notes as the Rav prepares when he talks. Rav Lef, when he told me what that I should be doing, I said, well, what does one do at a Sudat Hodeah? So the Rav took me into the Beis Medrash and pulled out the Chai Adam to the end of Hilchos Megillah. And I made a photocopy of that page, which I had someone help me sit down and go through carefully so I understand exactly what it's saying here. And this basically is the outline of the evening. So I'm going to start by telling you what the outline of the evening is, what we're going to do over here. The Chai Adam himself talks a little bit about the tragedy from which he and his family were saved, and then he goes into the details of what one does at a Sudat Hodeah. So just to summarize, I'm not going to go through it in detail. He says, first of all, one lights candles like on a Yom Tov. So we have done that. That is why there are candles lit over here, because the Chai Adam says to light candles like on a Yom Tov. A person is supposed to give tzedakah, which, Baruch Hashem, I've already done this evening. And so I'm Yotze, that part of what I'm supposed to do. I'm supposed to gather a number of Lomdei Torah for a Suda. to be a Sudat Hodaya, which is, I think, Baruch Hashem, I've succeeded in doing that as well. A person is then to speak in detail about what happened, what experience he went through, to show the niflot of Hashem, the wonderful things that he did, and how the person was saved. And he also mentions a number of particular tefillot to say, which, begging everyone's indulgence to be involved personally in the mitzvot we're doing tonight. After I speak and after Rav Lev speaks, I'm going to hand out sheets with photocopies of what we're going to say, and hopefully everyone will want to participate, and we'll do that together. Hopefully at that point we'll have dessert and bench, and that's the outline for the evening. Seeing that, I'm up to the part about telling the story, so that's what I'm going to get to. The prologue to the story is that when I was 17 years old in 1986, I don't know how many years ago that is right now, 86, so that's, all right, whatever that is ago, it's too long. I was in my last year of high school at the age of 17, and I was a pretty rebellious, modern Orthodox teenager at the time. I wasn't so into my Torah learning and so forth, but the Rav that I had that year, the Rebbe I had, his name is Rabbi Moshe Parnas from Lakewood, still teaching at the same school till today, took upon himself, outside of the regular curriculum of Gemara and other things that we were learning, to teach us in a very, very heartfelt way the halachot of Maaser, of giving Maaser. And one of the reasons why it's wonderful that I get a chance to mention it today is because we read it in the Parsha today, Aser to Aser. And he taught us a lot of deeper meanings of Aser to Aser. Of course, the common one that I think everyone is familiar with, Aser, Kedei Shita Aser, give Maaser in order that you shall become rich. He said that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, when a person gives Maaser, and is very carefully and medactic on how much he gives, and he's doing it L'shem Maaser, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu pays you back, not just in Schar Olam Haba, but also in Olam Hazeh, in dollars and cents, and many times over whatever you give. And Lemaisa, a person who gives Maaser, is going to get a lot of money back, much more than he gave. So that sounded good to me. The other thing he said, which he quoted the Navi, I don't remember where it is, but Hashem says, test me in this. Test me that if you won't give the Maaser, that I won't make you rich. And among other things, he explained to us that that means that even if a person gives Maaser, just because he wants to get rich, just because he wants to give the money back, even if that's his only motivation, he doesn't care about chesed, he doesn't care about helping anybody else, that is still something that he is doing, that Hashem promises he's going to get the schar, as if he was doing it out of the purest heart, out of pure chesed reasons, and it's the only mitzvah that has that that fact accompanied with it. So that sounded good to me too. So at the age of 17, when I wasn't so shomer mitzvot in many ways, I did take upon myself that I was going to be very careful and to pay maaser on everything I was giving. I was one of the only kids in my class who actually had a job at the time. And I used to go to Crazy Eddie's after high school. It's an electronics store. For those of you who don't know back from in the U.S., it's a big electronics store with crazy TV commercials. That's why everyone remembers them. And I used to get $100 a week. It was probably, so of course, the next week I got my paycheck on Friday. And I took $10 and I gave it to the Rav, to my Rebbe. And he took the $10 and put it in his Maaser fund. I think I did that twice. So that was $20. And the third week came along, and I went to the office on Friday to get my paycheck. And there was a check. I opened up, $350 inside the envelope. And there's no bonuses, no commissions. It was $100. That's what I was supposed to be getting. I'd been getting that for 6 months already. And I didn't know what to do, but I wasn't such a good boy, so I didn't tell anyone. I just deposited it. The following week, I went to the office to pick up my check. And the lady in the office, the secretary, said, I'm sorry, you have to go to the manager's office, the manager of the branch manager, because he has your check this week. So, of course, now I was a little nervous because I did deposit the check after all. So I went to him and he said, oh, I apologize that you had to come to me. It's just that I had to open up your envelope because there was a mistake in our payroll system last week. And a few people got checks that they weren't supposed to get. So I had to make sure this week's check was fine. But the management's decided the few mistakes were just letting them slide. Whatever you got, you got. So I had given $20 2 weeks earlier. And now it was up $250 or $230. And I realized that Rabbi Parnas knew what he was talking about. And Baruch Hashem, since then, I've maintained an Excel spreadsheet tracking as closely as I can. It's very, very difficult. Asking Shilas, making sure I know what I'm doing. And I really do credit the fact that our financial situation has been pretty good and my career has been pretty good to this fact. So anyway, it's in this week's Parsha. I wanted to mention that as an introduction to the story. And I strongly encourage anyone who doesn't do it very, very careful to do it carefully because it pays. Okay. Onto the 15-year-old file from my computer. Okay, it's a little long-winded. Forgive me, I hope you enjoy it anyway. I blinked. It was a very light shade of blue, but quite bright. Wispy clouds were twisted into gentle swirls. It was the first sight I saw after it happened, although at that moment I didn't even know anything had happened. It is strange that the mind always assumes that everything is in a normal state.
The air tasted sweet and fresh. It never smells that way in the city. I remember quite clearly thinking that it must have been early morning. My mind was quick enough to come to that conclusion. It was only weeks later that I found out that it was about 6:30 in the morning. A moment later, I noticed a girl up and to my right. She was looking down at me, the sky large sheet stretched out behind her. I now realized that I was lying on my back outside. Strangely enough, the question of why I was lying outside on my back in the early morning did not occur to me. She asked my name. She was about 15 or 16, I guessed, had very black skin. A man standing behind her must have been her father. Next to him was the white Chevy van we had been in. "Joel," I replied simply. She asked me what my friend's name was and pointed to my left. I looked towards the left, and in the corner of my eye, I saw my brother-in-law Stuart lying there on his back too. "Oh," I answered, "that's my brother-in-law Stuart." The girl told me that he was not awake. The man who I assumed was her father came and pulled her away. She smiled as she rose, saying that help was on its way. As I opened my eyes, I felt a strange vibration. The smell of alcohol in my nostrils informed me that I was in a doctor's office or a hospital. Ah, it was an ambulance. I heard a moaning coming from my right. Again, for some reason, I could only look from the corner of my eye, but I saw a medic bending over someone. The moaning continued for another moment until I realized that it was Stuart again. They were trying to put an IV in his arm, but he was moaning and resisting. The medic next to me told me that she would have to put one in me too. I laughed and told her simply that I was really fine and that an IV would be completely unnecessary. She also informed me that I had a bad gash in the back of my head and that I would definitely need stitches. Oh no, I thought, I hate stitches. I don't remember exactly what the driver said next, but the general idea was that we had to stop in order to wait for another ambulance to take us the rest of the way. That was the first time I thought about why I was an ambulance, where I was going, and what happened. But before the question came to my lips, I drifted again into the darkness that I found out later was unconsciousness. I didn't write this here, but by the way, the reason the ambulance had to stop and wait for another ambulance, because we had run out of gas, because we were so far in the middle of the desert that the ambulance didn't have enough gas to get both ways. I heard the same moaning again, except this time it was less intense and more persistent. Where was I? I was afraid to open my eyes. Somehow the darkness and solitude of my own dreams seemed much more comforting and secure than what I might find if I opened my eyes. I decided to keep them closed for a while longer and listen to the various sounds that my mind had started to sort out. Besides, just like a dream, I knew the security would vanish the moment I opened my eyes. I heard many voices, many sounds. There were footsteps, tapping, doors opening and closing, curtains being slid back and forth on tracks. I heard curtains like that before. Where was it? Yes, at the changing booths in the department store I went to before the trip. I was trying on a new pair of jeans, and in the bag on the shelf next to me were the new boots I had just purchased at the shoe store next door. They were large and heavy, but the salesman said at that time that they would be very comfortable on a hiking trip. After all, that's what I wanted them for, so I took them. Besides, they were on sale. But he was wrong. They were not at all comfortable. Again, I had a momentary blank. How did I know they were uncomfortable? Oh, I remembered. I had worn them on the plane to Los Angeles. They were tight, and they were painful, and after a few hours, I was dying to take them off. The man sitting next to me on the plane noticed my discomfort and explained that it takes a few days of wear to break in a new pair of leather boots. Fantastic. I was going camping the next day, and my boots were going to kill me. Wait, where am I? Oh, the moaning again. I must have slipped into my dreams again. This time I forgot to keep my eyes closed, and instead I automatically opened them. Wow, the light was bright. I quickly shut them tight and felt the tears squeeze out and onto my cheeks. Oh, you're awake. Good. I squinted up at the figure standing over me. I'm going to put a needle in your arm now for an intravenous drip. It will hurt for a moment. I felt the stick in my arm, but the pain seemed remote. The doctor will be here soon, and then she was gone. On the ceiling above me, there was a bright light. It was one of those flat fluorescent types that had four bulbs in parallel. It's funny the things that one notices at times like that. I heard Stuart moaning again. I tried to call him, but no sound came from my mouth. I tried to turn my head in the direction of the sound, but I could not turn my head. It was strange, I thought at the time, that I couldn't do these simple things. I looked out from the left corner of my eye, but could only see a curtain hanging next to my bed. I resigned myself to my situation and decided that if I wanted to wake up a little more, I'd be able to move and maybe get up. After all, there was no reason I could think of why I wouldn't be able to get up. It seemed like a long time until anyone else came. In that time, I was able to figure out that I was in the emergency room of a hospital. Happened to be in a town called St. George, Utah. There was no other explanation for the ambulance trip, the moaning, the other sounds, and of course that ever-present alcohol smell. Finally, the doctor came along with an orderly. The orderly stood over to my left and the doctor to my right. "My name is Dr. David Moore," he began. "You have broken your neck. You have a compression-decompression fracture of the fifth vertebrae known as C5. He went on to describe the injury, complete with a picture he drew as he spoke. Unfortunately, the notebook he was holding was somewhere off to the right where there was no way for me to see it. He was so engrossed in doing his drawing and his monologue that he didn't notice that I couldn't see. Meanwhile, I was looking up at the orderly on the other side who was trying to figure out why I was looking at him instead of what the doctor was drawing. For some reason, I found it quite humorous at the time. "You're very fortunate," he continued. "Had your bone slid an additional millimeter or two, you surely would have been paralyzed from the neck down or even killed. But we must now take steps to assure that the neck is held stable and that it will be unable to move and risk causing you more harm. They explained to me in more detail, whatever, the spinal cord goes through the vertebrae. If the vertebrae moves, and it cuts the spinal cord, so it usually causes death or paralysis. And he told me that it was pretty miraculous. Like, given the type of injury I had, I wasn't quadriplegic. That means paralyzed from the neck down, because apparently in that kind of situation, that's generally what happens. We have two choices, he said. We can operate now and do what we call a cervical fusion operation that will weld a piece of metal and some pieces of bone to stabilize your neck, or we can put you in an orthopedic device that will give your neck a chance to heal on its own. Which do you prefer? Suddenly, a number of questions about this doctor, my whole situation, and what was going on sprang to mind. How did I break my neck? Is this as bad as it sounds? Am I going to heal? Will I be paralyzed? Does he realize that I've just woken up? And how the heck does he expect me to decide what I should do? I cleared my throat and finally found my voice. My father is a doctor in New Jersey, I told him. Please call him and ask him what he thinks. I gave the doctor the phone number. He said he'd be back soon, and then he walked away. I was very impressed with my quick thinking. I thought to myself at that time that I had just made a very wise decision. My next thought turned back to my injury, a broken neck. That sounded very serious. But I felt no pain. In fact, I felt fine, if not a bit tired. If my neck was injured, then maybe I wouldn't feel anything. That scared me. But I did feel it when I was stuck with the needle. My thoughts continued along these lines for a while, and I only became more confused. I willed myself to relax and stop thinking about it. A moment later, I heard Dr. Moore speaking about me. He was describing my injuries in medical jargon. I assumed he was speaking to my father. The conversation continued for a while, and I realized that the moaning next to me had stopped. I made a mental note to ask the doctor how Stuart was. A few minutes later, Dr. Moore came back to my bed and told me that he spoke to my father, and that my father, along with some doctor friends of his back at home, had decided that the orthopedic device was the right treatment at this time. I was glad that at least doctors in New Jersey know what to do. What state was I in anyway? A number of orderlies and nurses came shortly thereafter and lifted me onto a gurney. The next few hours are fairly vague in my memory. I remember being taken for x-rays and various other tests, but I think I was asleep most of the time. Then I heard Dr. Moore's voice again trying to wake me up. He explained that they were about to begin to assemble this device around me. It's called a halo vest because of the metal ring that gets attached around the head, and then that ring is connected to a vest that is to be worn on the torso. The worst part of it now, he said, was that the ring had to be fastened into my skull with four screws. I remember clearly thinking that having screws put into the skull must be a very uncomfortable experience, and I told him so. He then informed me that I would have to remain awake during this procedure, lest they bend my neck in an incorrect position and I'm unable to tell them of any odd sensations I have anywhere in my body. Local anesthetic would be used. Just to give you an idea, I went to the internet. My own photos of this whole story are in storage at House 65, but I did find a couple pictures on the internet of what this halo thing looks like. And kind of just get an idea. That's not me, but that's what I looked like for about 5 months. The first injection in my scalp almost caused me to pass out from the pain. Dr. Moore, I said between clenched teeth, if you do another one of those, I won't be with you much longer. The searing pain was indescribable. I've already put 2 milligrams of Valium in your IV, he said, but I can increase it to the maximum dose. Wait a moment. He did something behind me, and then I felt great. I think it may have even smiled. It was incredible how rapidly a drug can enter one's brain and have such an effect. I felt wonderful, and all the pain vanished. They commenced inserting the first pin. Aside from the general pressure that I could feel, however, there was no pain. The rest of the procedure is a veritable blank. I remember it only as I remember a fleeting dream from the night before. The next 2 days exist in my memory now as if they were a daydream. I remember everything that happened, but it feels as if I was someone else observing instead of myself. I think I woke up later that first night. I was in a room by myself, propped up in a hospital bed. I felt a strange pressure around my head, and I couldn't see myself, so I commenced a manual exploration of my newfound metal companion. The halo itself was a cold metallic ring, roughly 1/4 inch thick and 3/4 inch high. It sat around my head, situated at a height just above my ears. 4 screws protruded out of my head through the halo and continued to extend out about 1/2 inch past the ring. As I touched the surface of my head where each pin, as it's technically called, entered, I felt a slight twinge of pain. 4 rods extended down from the halo and connected to a body vest that I wore. The vest, unable to move relative to my body, held the halo and therefore my head immobile. The whole contraption served, in a sense, as a glorified cast. My neck was broken, and this device held it in place in order to give it a chance to heal on its own. The logic of this situation did not allay my feelings of distress at the realization that I would have to live with this thing for some extended time period. I had no idea at that point how many ways the device would affect my life for the next few months. All right, I'm just going to skip a little bit here. Spent the next couple days in the hospital. My dad came out from New Jersey, took me home, very drugged up. We had been married a year at the time. I was 21 at the time this happened. Trace and I were married when we were 20. She met us in the airport and told me it was one of the most pathetic sights she ever saw in her life. This drugged out guy in this halo in a wheelchair coming off the plane. They did take me off the plane before anyone else, though. So, skip ahead a little bit. Okay. It's ironic that a vacation intended to provide me with freedom, exhilaration, and pleasure became the start of a 5-month period of entrapment, restriction, and pain. After a terrible, terrible few months, the end of the ordeal had finally arrived. The halo of... Oh, wait, I skipped a very important part. Wait 1 second. Ah, okay. I just go back. The end of the ordeal had finally arrived. The halo was finally traded in for a soft collar to assist in holding up my head. After months of non-use, my neck had become quite weak, and I could barely hold my head up for a few minutes at a time. My prognosis was within a few months I should regain full movement of my head and neck and return to normal. Let me now recount briefly the experience between my return from the hospital in Utah and the final removal of the halo. Upon my return to New Jersey, I went to see Dr. Sanford Feynman, an experienced neurosurgeon and a friend of my father's, to decide on my course of treatment. He explained to me that my x-ray showed clearly that the damaged bone, and he felt that the best approach was to give my neck 3 months to heal on its own. In 75% of these cases, he explained, the bones do heal on their own and no further action is necessary. So for these 3 months, I continuously saw the doctor, had new x-rays done, the progress was looking good, and that's how I lived. Life in a halo vest is difficult and frustrating. So many simple actions were no longer easy. My head was held at a slightly up-tilted angle, so I could not easily see what was in front of me.
Sort of like that.
I could bend only at the waist, so in order to see the floor before me, I had to bend almost all the way over. Sitting at a table to eat, for example, I could simply not see the plate of food in front of me unless I was at an arm's length from the table, bending over. I couldn't finish a glass of water since I couldn't tilt my head back enough to drink. In order to read a book, I had to hold it up before my face with outstretched arms. Most difficult was that I could not go for a walk alone since I could not see the ground in front of me and a fall could have had disastrous consequences. I, of course, could not drive a car. Being such an independent individual, sitting at home for months at a time almost caused me to go crazy. Nighttime was also awful. Because of the whole vest, I couldn't sleep flat. Hence, we rented an electric hospital bed for the entire period. I slept only on my back and could not roll over. Every time I felt the natural urge to lie on my side, I woke myself up. The nights were long and difficult. I could go on, but I feel that the small picture painted here says enough. I maintained a generally positive attitude. I had friends that came by and visited me and kept me busy. I looked longingly forward to the end of the 3 months so that life could begin to return to normal. But I was in for a surprise. The doctor removed the apparatus after seeing in the x-rays that the bones had, in fact, healed beautifully. He was confident that I was healed. After removal of the halo, I went for special x-rays called flexion extension x-rays. To examine the movement inside my neck. I stood on a platform in front of the machine and was instructed to move my head in various ways. After months in the halo, it felt very odd to move my head. Suddenly, while I was bending my head forward at one point, I felt dizzy and passed out. When I awoke on the floor a few minutes later, I was surrounded by nurses and doctors who told me that my doctor would be there in a minute. He came to me with a grave look on his face. He explained to me that while the bones had in fact healed well, the ligaments which hold the various vertebrae together had been permanently damaged. I would need the cervical fusion operation after all. He scheduled it for a few days later. My disappointment was immeasurable. This day was supposed to be the end of the ordeal. Instead, it became the start of a new and much more painful one. The halo was reapplied in a replay of the first time months before. Lying on a bed, drugged and restrained, with a man screwing pins into your skull with dizzying pain is like a nightmare scene from a horror movie. The operation was performed a few days later, and I remained in the hospital for a week before I returned home to begin another period, this time for 2 months, of recuperation in the halo. The operation itself involves cutting deep into the back of the neck, right into the spine. Metal clamps and wires are permanently situated to hold together the vertebrae. Additionally, a piece of rib is removed from one's back and is chopped into pieces and placed between the vertebrae whose ligaments were destroyed. The net effect of this procedure is to prevent movement of these bones, which could pinch or damage the spinal cord, possibly resulting in paralysis or death. In fact, the three vertebrae are now fused together and serve as one. The first few days of recovery was yet another hell. My wife wasn't sure I should say that word. There is no point in delving into the details of it. Suffice it to say that I hope I am dead before I ever have to experience surgery like that. The next few weeks were the most difficult of the whole ordeal. I now had 8 holes in my head from the 2 halo installations, a cut in my back that had to heal, an 8-inch cut down my neck. Additionally, the muscles of my neck and shoulders were, as the doctor explained, moved quite a bit during the surgery, and they've never quite returned to normal. To this day, they often become stiff and sore. Finally, the whole thing was over. I do not know why I was chosen to experience this trial, but it has had the result of strengthening me in many ways. All right, blah, blah, blah. Okay, said it. That's what happened to me. I just want to finish now with an epilogue. I started with the prologue of the Meister story and the tzedakah that I had been giving. And of course, we know that tzedakah tzotzil mimavis. Rabbi Parnas from Lakewood in New Jersey there had as his rav a Rav Dan Zev Halevi Segal in Bnei Brak. And twice during that school year, he sent the tzedakah that he had collected from us in the class to Rav Segal in Israel. And both times, Rav Segal had sent us back a letter of bracha. And Rav Parnas took these letters and photocopied them for whoever wanted them and strongly encouraged us to put these letters of bracha in our pockets, in our wallets, and keep them there because it would be a tremendous segula and would save us. So anyway, that was 1986, which is... how many years? So help me here. I'm on stage. I can't think. 19 years ago. So for 19 years, I've had these two letters in my wallet. They're in pretty bad shape, but... they're here, and they were in my pocket at the time of the accident, and one can only assume that the bracha and having this apparently very chashuv gadol letter of bracha in my pocket was part of the reason that that I'm here today.
Actually about the car accident. So what actually happened?
Okay, so we were driving. Good point. I had a few days off before my next semester of college started, and I had gotten a free ticket or a $50 ticket out anywhere in the country. So I flew out to Los Angeles. My brother-in-law lived out there, and the two of us had he got permits for us to go hiking and sleeping over camping in the Grand Canyon. And this was the beginning of my trip to the Grand Canyon. I arrived on a Sunday. Our ticket was for the first thing Monday morning, which he hadn't realized until I got there and read the fine print. So we were planning to leave Monday morning and get there Monday afternoon. It's about a 6-7 hour drive. We ended up having to leave about midnight. I think we left Sunday night. I was tired from the trip and whatever, so I said, I'll drive the first shift of 3 hours, which I did. My brother-in-law drove the second 3 hours. We took turns. Whoever wasn't driving was sleeping on the back seat of the car. And unfortunately, while my brother-in-law was driving during his second shift, he fell asleep at the wheel. And apparently there were no other cars involved, but really all I know about the accident is a little bit what's written in the police report about the car. I skipped that part of the story, that the car, we saw it afterwards, it was smashed from all four sides, all four corners, all the windows were smashed out. I mean, the thing was a piece of junkyard. It looked like it came from a junkyard. My brother-in-law had a concussion. He had some cuts and bruises, but within a week or two, I think he was healed. But I had what I had, and I thank Hashem. I stand here and publicly I thank Hashem for keeping me alive and for keeping me basically healthy, certainly able to lead a normal life. I have, Baruch Hashem, a wonderful wife and four children, and even the pain and discomfort that I experience now, so even that's a chesed from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, because no doubt I deserve plenty of onesh, and one of the chasadim that I've learned of the way Hashem punishes is He doesn't give it to you all in one shot, He divides it over, so a little bit of discomfort or pain in my neck over a period of a few decades, I'm sure is a big chesed as well. So anyway, I thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu for everything He's given me, and I'd like to ask Rav Lev to say a few words.